What is this?
A center for ants!
I'll have what she's having.
It's not a tumor.
Surely you can't be serious.
I am serious. And don't call me Shirley.
Life was like a box of chocolates. You never know what you're going to get.
First rule of Fight Club is, you do not talk about Fight Club.
This is Sparta!
I have a feeling we're not in Kansas anymore.
Go ahead. Make my day.
Nightlife at the movies.
Yes, here to take us on a wander through the latest out of Hollywood and our own industry. CJ Johnson's here, and it's a bit dark this week. CJ, good evening.
Good evening. Yes, both the films I've got to talk about, Dom, are pretty dark. There's no doubt about it. One of them is ludicrously dark, and one of them is sort of humanely dark, but they're both dark.
So let's start with the one closer to home, Joe Cinque's Consolation.
Yes. Did you read the book, Joe Cinque's Consolation? Do you remember when it was a big deal?
There was a lot of talk about it.
Yeah. Helen Garner's book came out, I guess, around 2004, 2005, based on actual events that occurred in Canberra around 1997. And I don't know why, but at the time, I remember just hearing constantly about this book. I guess I had a lot of friends who read it. It was a book that I kept meaning to read. It might have been a big Christmas book. Like, it was definitely in the cultural air, certainly among the circles I was moving in. And it was kind of the book I felt guilty for not having read. And I guess I haven't read a lot of Helen Garner, and I sort of assumed, probably mistakenly, that it might be relatively dry and academic, but now that I've seen the film, I realize that that almost certainly was not the case. Anyway, as I understand it, the book was essentially about the trial of a couple of women involved in the death of a young man, Joe Cinque. And what this film does, a lot later now, we're looking, you know, as I say, at events that happened in the late 90s.
Just on 20 years ago.
Yeah, is look at the same events, but the way I understand it differs from the book is that the book really focuses mainly on the trial, and this adaptation follows the events that lead up to the trial. So it follows the events more specifically about this crime that was committed.
So the book was, a piece of journalism looking at the legal process. This is a reconstruction of what they established happened.
Yes, yes. This is more of a true crime story. So the crime itself took place very much within the environs of academia in Canberra. And one of the interesting things about this film is that it is full of Canberra. This is a real Canberra movie. There are so many shots of Canberra and of the lake in Canberra and of people cycling in Canberra and of the trees in Canberra. And it really sort of, in a way, goes overboard in showing Canberra as this sort of idyllic, gorgeous place, which is obviously done to counterpoint the fact that the story it's telling is very dark. At the beginning of the film, a young man with a promising engineering career, a guy named Joe Cinque, meets this law student, Anu, her name is, and they hit it off. But she very quickly points out to him, oh, have you heard anything about me? You might have heard bad things about me. You might have heard that I, for example, have been with a lot of men, or that I am quite promiscuous, or that I'm a little mentally unstable. And he falls for her anyway. And as things turn out, she is certainly mentally unstable, and events start accumulating and leading to a murder. But the big famous thing about, I guess, the book and the story, the true story that it tells and that this film tells, is that this woman with an accomplice, with a female accomplice, essentially held two dinner parties to be the prelude to a murder-suicide. And the first dinner party she held, nothing really worked and nothing went to plan and nothing happened. And then the second dinner party, things did happen.
This seems completely surreal, and it's worth noting that someone listening may have had some personal connection to these people or the story. So I'm sure these wounds are very raw. So we're playing in a story that, particularly given the interest at the time, I guess the stakes are high for potentially people listening and reacting and going and seeing the story on the screen.
Yes, I guess the stakes are high. And I would be very curious, because most of these people, I'm sure, are still alive. They were uni students in the 90s, essentially. Essentially, the main characters are all uni students or people who have just graduated university, but young Canberra people. these people were invited to these dinner parties knowing where the dinner parties were leading. They were being invited to, in the first instance, a suicide dinner party, and they went. And so the thing about the film that is truly fascinating is it is so much stranger than fiction, because if you were watching this film and you knew it was total fiction, you would kind of walk out at the implausibility of it, because all these people are being invited to come to a dinner party at which they know someone at the end of the dinner party plans to commit suicide to a quote-unquote farewell party, and they go along with it. No one calls the cops, no one seeks to stop, no one says no, and it's weird because they don't seem to be drawn by a fascination with with the grotesque. And in fact,
I'm thinking of sort of Heathers, another film from the 90s, where there's this morbid fascination with death and suicide and all these kinds of things. But this is real.
This is real. And so it is that sort of strange collective decision-making amongst a group of, let's say, 8 people or 10 people at the first dinner party anyway, to go to something that they know is just so outside of social norms that it is just absolutely bizarre. And I think part of the way the film manages to frame it is through this framing device of Canberra, is showing Canberra as kind of a city that exists unto itself. And at one point, there's a couple of the characters have a bit of an argument about Canberra, and one of them sort of slightly denigrates Canberra, and this other one, who happens to be either a heroin addict or at least a heroin user, suggests that Canberra is almost the perfect city because you can essentially get away with anything. That it is a city that allows anything as long as you don't ruffle the waters too much.
So the suburban macabre here.
Yeah, exactly. There's this sort of weird Canberra gothic going on, which is quite interesting. Unfortunately, the film doesn't attempt beyond such things to try and get into the psychology of all of these other people. And so it does remain a little bit frustratingly mysterious as to why all these intelligent people, they were all law students, essentially, law students or young engineers, why they would go along with something. And at the center of the film, you have a lead character, this lead female character, Anu, whose pathology is so difficult to place one's finger on that it also becomes, I guess, a little frustrating, but in a good way, because she is certainly a very, very unique character. I mean, from scene to scene and within scenes, the level of very extremely odd, dangerous, scary, manipulative behavior on display is pretty breathtaking. Now, she is still alive, and so is her accomplice, and they've served their terms, and they are still out there. I gather that they had nothing to do with this film. It's always a curiosity when a film like this comes out to know how close it hews to the facts and how much is speculation. But it's a very interesting story, and it makes me want to go read the book now, because I gather the book kind of starts where this film ends off.
And if this discussion of suicide and death has triggered anything for you, if you want to talk to someone, 13 11 14 is the number for Lifeline, lifeline.org.au. They're always there to help out, just in case what we've been talking about has brought something up for you. Now, CJ, your second movie tonight is an LA-based movie, another city where I guess a bit of darkness is on the record, perhaps more famously so than Canberra. Tell us about The Neon Demon.
Yeah, well, The Neon Demon is so bonkers and so fictional that real trigger warnings need not apply here, because it's really just absolute. It's a total fantasy. Do you know the work of Nicholas Winding Refn at all? Okay, Nicholas Winding Refn is a Danish director who made some really good, tough street drug thriller films in Denmark called the Pusher Trilogy. And they gave us Mads Mikkelsen to the world.
Oh.
And they were really, really interesting. There were these
excellent
three interconnected stories about life as junkies and drug dealers on the streets of Denmark. And then he gave us a film called Bronson, which gave us Tom Hardy, brought Tom Hardy to national acclaim. Very, very art house, very out there, very stylized piece of work about one of Britain's most infamous boxers slash inmates slash criminals. And then he gave us Drive. And Drive was a very unique film with Ryan Gosling, because it really wore all of its strange art houseness on its sleeve.
Yeah, I did see Drive, and actually this description of this film reminded me of that kind of bizarreness and the neon-soaked kind of hyper-reality of that film.
Yes, well, with Drive, he really sort of found the distillation of his style, which he has now maintained, because Drive became a huge worldwide hit. It was a massive, massive success in a way that nobody expected for the kind of film it was. It was very, very violent. It was, while not as stylized as his previous films, it was still a stylized movie. And you remember the use of music in that film and the use of neon lights, his favorite thing in the world, and neon colors, and kind of an interesting sort of 80s retro aesthetic combined with a hip modernism. And that was his thing, and ultra-violence. So he followed Drive with a terrible, terrible movie called Only God Forgives, which also had Ryan Gosling, but I find almost unwatchable. It just so up itself, for want of a better word, so pretentious, so slow, so nothing happens, and so stylized as to almost be the proverbial piece of masturbatory cinema. But now he's come back with something that is edging back towards some form of acceptability while still being absolutely out to lunch. So The Neon Demon is about models in Los Angeles. And it begins very much in a sort of Mulholland Drive way, except instead of a young actress, it's a young model played by Elle Fanning arriving in Los Angeles, completely isolated. Parents are supposedly dead, supposedly has no other family, stunningly beautiful. And other model types instantly recognize in her the kind of thing that's going to take her far, or at least take her far for a little while, which is the fact that she's so innocent, that she's gorgeous but unjaded. And essentially, it is about how that innocence gets sucked out of her, gets ripped out of her, gets brutalized out of her by an industry that is portrayed in this film as about the worst aspect of the entertainment industry possible.
A neon demon.
Yes. And as an indictment of the modeling industry, it's terrific, because everything that you imagine about the way that people speak to each other in relation to body type and healthy eating or the lack of and all of this sort of stuff, it's all there, and it's all brutally put forward in this stylized way. What he then does is uses violence and sort of horror tropes to actually manifest this concept of modeling as a vicious industry. In reality, he actually starts kind of bringing in models as monsters, and it kind of goes off the rails into, once again, some grotesque violence and graphic horror imagery, while always maintaining essentially being an extremely dark, no-laugh satire of the modeling industry. All the actresses are really good. He's got these real models essentially lambasting their industry. The Australian Abby Lee, who's a model actress, she's in it. She's very good. She's playing Australian in it. She's essentially playing herself. They're all sort of playing themselves in a way, these models. Elle Fanning is very good. And Keanu Reeves shows up as a really despicable motel owner.
Go figure.
Which is quite interesting.
Welcome back, Keanu.
Yeah, and he's pretty good. Alessandro Nivola's in it as a sleazy type. Everyone in the movie is sleazy, except Elle Fanning. That's sort of the point, that she is innocent and the world around her is terrifying. It's also completely sparse. Mm. Like, it represents the idea of being a new arrival in Los Angeles and being lonely as essentially being alone. So in any given shot, in any given circumstance, except for the people who are directly related to a scene with her, there's no one else. There's no one in the background except music and neon. So if you like that kind of extremely out there, art house stylized, spooky, graphically violent, dark satire, this will work for you, but it is really, really, really far from the mainstream, as it were.
Okay, so there you go. Worth seeing?
Yes. Yes. As I say, if that sort of thing appeals to you, absolutely worth seeing. He's kind of one of these directors that if you've got on his train, you may as well stay on it.
Yeah. She was in somewhere, wasn't she? Another film about empty LA from Sofia Coppola.
Elle Fanning?
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. I mean, she's really, really good. She was also in Super 8, and she stole that when she was only like 11. I think she's the younger sister of Dakota Fanning.
Yeah, that makes sense.
And she's really, really good. She's a face to watch. And Jenna Malone is in it, who I've liked ever since she was in Donnie Darko.
Ha, there you go. Thanks very much, CJ.
Cheers, Dom.
CJ Johnson, reviewing movies for you here on a Tuesday night, and you can check out his podcast as well, Movieland. Just put Movieland into your podcast app of choice.